My name is Paul Olson, and this is the session on African American Fiction, A Cause for Celebration. I've been at Holden now for a little more than a week, and I've taught several different kind of units on African American literature, and from time to time it's appropriate to explain how a white Norwegian from Minnesota would ever get interested in African American literature, interested enough to pursue it, you know, to some length. And I don't explain that each time because I don't think it's that's not our issue. But at the same time, it's relevant to lots of us, I think, because right now, as I look in this room, we're all white. How do you get hooked on this? And I don't tell my story each time because that would put people to sleep, but I tell different segments of it at different points. Anyway, with all that in mind, to start this section, I'm actually going to look at, for just a moment, Cry of the Beloved Country by Alan Paton, which is a book about South Africa. And that is not really what this day's discussion will be about. But this suggests, or he articulates for me, why I have gotten involved in African American literature. And I suspect he might articulate for lots of you the whole sense of caring about all our sisters and brothers. The situation here, it really doesn't matter so much, is that but it helps get this, it's a real short excerpt. In South Africa, an elderly white gentleman who's been what you'd call a liberal has been really kind of for, let's treat the blacks fairly, but not for, we'll treat them fairly, but no real change in the status quo that's going to make the system change and make for some economic and social changes in the country. Well, this elderly gentleman has a son who is, of course, white, and you'd call him, I think, a radical. And he really is working for change, great change in South Africa, and he is, somewhat ironically, I think, murdered by blacks. Not because of his political or social stand, but he's murdered by blacks because they were going to rob his house, and he kind of walked in on them, and they didn't know what to do. They got scared, and they threw something, and it hit him and killed him. Well, the old white man is looking through the journal of his now dead son, and this is one of the things. There are several pages of his journal, but this is one of the things that he reads. This is the radical son who has been killed. Therefore, I shall do, and one more statement then about that. This is kind of the history of my own personal, and perhaps yours, the reason a white person gets involved in issues that are black, because ultimately all issues are for all people. I'm reading that journal. Therefore, I shall devote myself, my time, my energy, my talents to the service of my country. I shall no longer ask myself if this or that is expedient, but only if it is right. I shall do this not because I am noble or unselfish, but because life slips away. I had been into African American literature for a long time before I read Cry of the Beloved Country. And I said, that's it. And images of people who were close friends of mine, black people who were close friends of mine, came to my mind as I said, I do this not because I'm noble or unselfish or anything special, only because life slips away. And it's so precious that why shouldn't I thought of Marina? This girl was from Namibia. Why should this woman I like so much have to go home to the degradation she's going to have to go home to? And a colleague of mine who's tried to work his way through the American educational system and met frustration after frustration. And if you know anything about that at all, you can sense that too. Why? So I struggle for that, says the man writing the journal and with whom I think I can try to identify. I'm not noble or unselfish, but because life slips away and we work to make everyone's life. Okay. And because I need for the rest of my journey a star that will not play false to me, a compass that will not lie. I shall do this not because I am a lover of blacks and a hater of my own, but because I cannot find it in me to do anything else. I am lost when I balance this against that. I am lost when I ask if this is safe. I am lost when I ask if men, white men or black men, white women or black women, Englishmen or Afrikaners, Gentiles or Jews will approve. Therefore, I shall try to do what is right and to speak what is true. I do this not because I am courageous and honest, but because it is the only way to end the conflict of my deepest soul. I do it because I am no longer able to aspire to the highest with one part of myself and to deny it with another. I don't know if Alan Payton is a Christian, but if that isn't a statement about Christianity, nothing is. To aspire to one thing with your soul. Think of the goodness, and I'm talking about theological and social, of Christianity, but not to aspire with something else. In our in the Holden Village language, I think, you can't be an environmentalist and not be for civil rights. You can't be for anti-sexist or any other kind of ist word you want to use and not be for all of them. You can't be. Because, and with, according to what Alan Payton tells us anyway, I am no longer able to aspire to the highest with one part of myself and to deny it with another. I do not wish to live like that. I would rather die than live like that. Well, that's the beginning. And that just kind of sets up my sense of my own involvement with this kind of literature. And that is only, again, one small dimension that's complicated and long. To start this, and what we're going to do today is I'm going to read some really, I think, dynamic, interesting kinds of episodes from black fiction, American black fiction. Before I do that, we're going to do two things. One, I'm just going to tell you why I wrote these books on the board. I think if you're new to African American literature, and I did that in Brown, these are good places to start. If you're already into some of that, kind of go wherever you want to. But I think Black Boy, it's a story of a boy growing up in America, and it will shock your socks off if you're new to that kind of literature. And I also picked these and not some others because these are all in the Holden bookstore, and you can get started right away. So Native Son and Black Boy by Richard Wright. He is clearly one of America's best writers ever. Ever. Somebody asked me he left already, the doctor that was in here before. He said, how do you get interested in black literature? And I said, it started off as an issue of American racism in education, and I thought it was unjust. And I went on with that to him just in a phrase. I had finished a master's degree in American literature, and I had never heard of Richard Wright. Well, that might be a statement against me, maybe, but I think even more it's a statement against the racist education system that we are all victim of, whether you're black or white. My black students at Augustana, now it's a little different, but they haven't read completely by a long shot in African American literature either. Anyway, so this guy, he's as good as, put Hemingway up there, put Faulkner up there. I would challenge any academician to say Wright is as good as they are. But because he was black, he got slipped in another kind of canon off to the side. Well, that's changing. Anyway, start there. Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, Beloved, are in our bookstore here. So is Sula, and I think so is The Bluest Eye. You mentioned you liked the tar Baby. It's a good book, too. But these are here in our bookstore. Alice Walker's The Color Purple. Also over there are The Temple of My Familiar and one other, but I can't remember which one it was, that's in the bookstore. And then The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Those are good places to start. If you're interested in justice for people of color, these books, these two, Cry the Beloved Country, Dry White Season, are in our bookstore, and they are about South Africa. Born of the Sun by Joseph Dischko is about Namibia, and we have two Namibian students here in the village. Okay, before we start, briefly, what's your favorite story in the Bible that Jesus tells? Not in my notes, whatever you like. Give me a story he tells and what you like about it. Anyone.
Prodigal Son.
Great story. Okay. We all know the story, right? The Prodigal Son. What do you like about that? We don't have to read it again.
Just the ending, I guess.
And what a good answer. What about the ending?
Well, the one that he comes back, but then there's this conflict with the brother and find out that the other one is completely forgiven. But I don't know about the older brother. He's still having problems.
Okay. There's conflict. There's resolution. In big words, but in the resolution between the brother, it does get resolved. He's between the father and the two sons. Anything else?
Forgiveness.
Yep. Forgiveness is a part of that.
Loving father.
And I'm going to write redemption too. Love. Unconditional love, huh? This father? And this kid did him dirty. Come on home. And not only am I glad you're home, we're going to celebrate. Good. Other things.
We can get into it because we can identify. So we can say,
yep. Identify. Here's primarily a bunch of white folks coming over to hear African-American literature. You going to be able to identify? Oh, amen. You watch. You will. And, okay, keep going.
The woman at the well.
How about just for time's sake, stay with this story.
Oh,
and that's okay. And then just see what other things that you like about the story. What is it that you liked? Because I want to move into this as soon as I can. But I'm setting up something to say that you're all very good literary critics, even though your English teachers way back then told you you weren't.
There's that little bit of resentment on the part of the brother. You can find yourself everywhere.
Yeah.
You don't only identify with the younger brother.
How about element of surprise?
Jealousy.
Confession.
Or another juicer. Surprise.
Confession on the part of the son.
Confession, time in, confession of forgiveness. Resentment up for the conflict. Really good. But we'll stop, because there's more you can say. I just want to set you up with one idea. Out of all of the specific ingredients, the images, the movements through the plot, out of those specific details, you've come up with some pretty abstract stuff. But if you start with the abstracts, let's talk about conflict today. Well, that's really tough to do. And then you don't get anywhere. You need to have the powerful images, Jesus knew it best, I think, in the whole New Testament, the stories that make all kinds of connectedness happen. Well, we're going to look at that, and then I'm going to look at this. I'll read the story to you, just some episodes, what I think are some good episodes from different African-American novels, and then let you talk about what are the abstractions that are there. What kinds of things energize you as you hear that? And the place to start, one of the places, the place I've chosen to start with, is Go Tell It on the Mountain by James Baldwin. Up on the kiosk, it says African American Literature Celebration. I think when you look at the body of African American literature, it's good reading always because it's adventurous. I mean, striking out for freedom, the slaves, if you read slave narratives. It's violent because the black experience historically is violent. It's full of identity seeking. It's full of the kinds of things that, it's full of struggles against oppression that we like to read. That is true. The body of African American literature, poetry, drama, fiction, all does that. It also profoundly celebrates life in spite of those things. And for instance, the title of Langston Hughes's best novel, Not Without Laughter. You know, look at this, you know, it's tough, but it's not without laughter. And it's a book primarily about unconditional love and the theme of that. Okay, I say all that because I'm going to start today with something that's about oppression and move from Baldwin's, this one episode about depression and oppression, into some things that celebrate life, that celebrate God, and that make a kind of affirmation of life sense to us. In this particular episode, Elizabeth and Richard are in love. And they're not married yet, but they're going to be. And Richard has walked Elizabeth to the door, gone on home, kissed her goodnight, and gone on home. And then he's disappeared for a couple days. And she realizes he's in trouble when a policeman comes to his landlady's house looking for him. And Elizabeth is there. You his girl? One of the policemen asked. Here, stand under the light here. She looked up at his sweating face on which a lascivious smile had immediately appeared and straightened, trying to control her trembling. Yes, she said, where is he? He's in jail, honey, the other policeman said. What for? For robbing a white man's store, black girl, that's what for. She found and thanked heaven for it, that a cold, stony rage had entered her. She would otherwise certainly have fallen down or begun to weep. She looked at the smiling policeman. Richard ain't robbed no store, she said. Tell me where he is. And I tell you, he said, not smiling, that your boyfriend robbed the store and he's in jail for it. He's going to stay there, too. Now, what you got to say to that? We'll go on, but just what's the first abstract thing you want to say about just that scene so far?
Angering.
Huh?
Angering.
To us, too. Right. Wait a minute. Good. Anything else? He ain't robbed no store. And I tell you that your boyfriend robbed a store and he's in jail for it.
There's conflict.
Conflict. Good. How about how she feels?
I mean, she's fearful too. I mean, I felt some fear.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Baldwin is a great writer, also one of America's best. I would argue that he's maybe America's best essay writer, and lots of great novels, too. Does Elizabeth know Richard? Mm-hmm. He ain't robbed no store. He wouldn't do that. I know him. And she says, I mean, get this picture. This is 1930, and this is a black woman telling a white cop, he ain't robbed no store. I know him. I'll keep going. You going to take me to see him? She asked of the remaining policeman. Sure, girl, he said. You're coming right along with us. The man at the station house wants to ask you some questions. And at the station, she somehow got past their brutal laughter. What was he doing with you, girl, until 2 o'clock in the morning? Next time you feel like that girl, you come by here and talk to me. She felt that she was about to burst or vomit or die. Though the sweat stood out cruelly like needles on her brow, and she felt herself from every side being covered with the stink and filth, she found out in their own good time what she wanted to know. He was being held in a prison downtown called the Tombs. The name made her heart turn over. And she could see him tomorrow. The state or the prison or someone had already assigned him a lawyer and he would be brought to trial next week. But the next day when she saw him, she wept. He had been beaten. He whispered to her and he could hardly walk. His body, she later discovered, bore almost no bruises but was full of strange, painful swellings and there was a welt above one eye. He had not, of course, robbed the store. But when he left her that Saturday night, had gone down into the subway station to wait for his train. It was late and trains were slow. He was all alone on the platform, only half awake, thinking, he said, of her. Then from the far end of the platform, he heard a sound of running. And looking up, he saw two colored boys come running down the steps. Their clothes were torn and they were frightened. They came up the platform and stood near him, breathing hard. He was about to ask them what the trouble was when, running across the tracks towards them and followed by a white man, he saw another colored boy. And at the same instant, another white man came running down the subway steps. Then he came full awake in panic. What's the situation? Just in a word, there's these white guys chasing these black guys, and here's this innocent bystander standing there waiting for the train. Is he just going to stand there waiting? It reminds me profoundly of a silly little episode of my own life on Halloween in this northern Minnesota town of 600 people. I knew everybody. They knew the name of my dog. And I was walking downtown with a couple of friends on Halloween night. It was about 10 o'clock. I was about 15 years old. And we saw the one cop in the whole town. We saw the cop go by, and we ran. Just because we knew he was on the lookout for somebody and we had tipped over a can someplace in somebody's house. And, but this was long ago. I mean, in the night we had done that, we ran, hid in the basement of a local restaurant, and the cop came down there right after. He said, all right, you guys, what have you been after? We haven't done anything. We said, well, then get home, and we sent us home. But we knew we'd be in trouble. Well, that's only a small kind of reference to this, if you're black in a white social, socially controlled by police system. Then he came full awake in panic. He knew that whatever the trouble was, it was now his trouble also. For these white men would make no distinction between him and the three boys they were after. They were all colored, they were all about the same age, and here they stood together on the subway platform. And they were all, with no questions asked, herded upstairs and into the wagon and to the station house. At the station, Richard gave his name and address and age and occupation. Then for the first time, he stated that he was not involved and asked one of the other boys to corroborate his testimony. This they rather despairingly did. They might, Elizabeth felt, have done it sooner, but they probably also felt that it would be useless to speak, and they would not be believed anyway. The owner of the store was being brought there to make the identification, and Richard tried to relax. The man could not say that he had been there, even if he had never seen him before. But when the owner came, a short man with a bloody shirt, for they had knifed him, in the company of yet another policeman, he looked at the four boys before him and said, "Yeah, that's them all right." Then Richard shouted, "But I wasn't there! Look at me, goddammit! Look at me! I wasn't there!" "You black bastards," the man said, looking at him, "you're all the same." "What are we going to do?" she asked at last. "Richard, what about another lawyer?" And he smiled. "I declare, Little Bits," that's what he calls her, Elizabeth Little, "Little Bits been holding out on me. She got a fortune tied up in a sock and she ain't never told me nothing about it. How are you getting another lawyer? We ain't got any money." She had been trying to save money for a whole year, but she had only $30. She sat before him, going over in her mind all the things she might do to raise money, even to going on the streets. I wrote in the margin of my book, "Love. I'll do anything." Then, for very helplessness, she began to shake with sobbing. At this, his face became Richard's face again. He said in a shaking voice, "Now, look here, Little Bit, don't you be like that. We're going to work this out all right." But she could not stop sobbing. "Elizabeth," he whispered, "Elizabeth, Elizabeth." And the man came and said that it was time for her to go, and she rose. She had brought two packs of cigarettes for him, and they were still in her bag. Wholly ignorant of prison regulations, she did not dare to give them to him under the man's eyes. And somehow, her failure to remember to give him the cigarettes when she knew how much he smoked made her weep the harder. She tried and failed to smile at him, and she was slowly led to the door. The sun nearly blinded her, and she heard him whisper behind her, "So long, baby. Be good." In one page, the trial comes. They can't identify him. So he's released. And then this last three paragraphs. He's free. But Richard was not sent away. Against the testimony of the three robbers and her own testimony and under oath, the storekeeper's indecision, there was no evidence on which to convict him. The courtroom seemed to feel, with some complacency and some disappointment, that it was his great good luck to be let off so easily. They went immediately to his room, and there she was never all her life long to forget it. He threw himself face downward on his bed and wept. She had only seen one other man weep before, her father, and it had not been like this. She touched him, but he did not stop. Her own tears fell on his dirty, uncombed hair. She tried to hold him, but for a long while he would not be held. His body was like iron. She could find no softness in it. She sat curled like a frightened child on the edge of the bed, her hand on his back, waiting for the storm to pass over. It was then that she decided not to tell him yet about the child. By and by he called her name, and then he turned and she held him against her breast, while he sighed and shook. He fell asleep at last, clinging to her as though he were going down into the water for the last time. And it was the last time. That night he cut his wrists with his razor, and he was found in the morning by his landlady, his eyes staring upward with no light, dead among the scarlet sheets.
"How come?"
"He made it. He got out."
"Why does he kill himself?"
the specifics of the story, the prodigal son. You ask, how come? Why is it? I'm asking the same kind of thing. And the place to answer, if you've been in one of my sessions before, you know what I'm going to say, is from your guts. Not your intellect. That'll come later. Just, how do you feel? Why did he do this?
Hopelessness.
Yeah, good answer.
And that this could happen again and again.
Yes. This, says Baldwin, is the black experience in America. You're invisible. You're all, black bastards are all the same. You know, we joke about it at Holden. Ah, Swedes all look alike. It's no joke among blacks. Why does any group of people all look alike? Whether it's Swede or whatever. But in one, you know, you can joke about it with Swedes because they're not oppressed people. What? Because what does Richard say to the policeman? And I love, the language is there. Baldwin does not throw in swear words to sensationalize his books. Look at me, goddammit, look at me! They never do.
That's the same with her, the treatment of her, it's girl, and it's all
very good.
Degrading.
Yep. When you feel like that, come see me, girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fiction, and we'll move on then, tells the truth. Fiction is one of the important vehicles for the truth of life's experiences. Well, let's move on to the Song of Solomon. More of the celebration and more of the awareness of I think, how the ostracized person comes to herself. I say herself, and this one, it's a woman is the hero of the story. The woman is named Pilate in Song of Solomon. I recommend this book highly. Pilate gets her name because her father just kind of goes to open the book, the Bible. He says, psh, he puts his finger on a name and Pilate, and everybody says, you can't name a woman Pilate. He said, it's the Bible, it's holy, and that's where my finger fell, that's her name. So her name is Pilate. And it's kind of indicative of the ostracization she's going to feel, ostracizing she's going to feel all her life. Well, her brother doesn't like her. Nobody seems to like her. And this is why. It's an interesting convention created by one of America's greatest authors, Toni Morrison. Pilate is born, again, this is fiction, of course, without a navel. That's her only fault. And at one point in the novel, it says that she was ostracized by everybody, but this fault, it wasn't freakish enough to put her in a carnival or someplace. It just, men would look at her and say, my God, one of them says, what are you, some kind of mermaid? And women would talk behind their backs, and anyway, she's out of everything. So, as I'll read to you in a moment, she decides to look at life with different eyes because she can't get all those things that society offers, the things that we pursue madly, so she decides to pursue something else. But first off, she has this conflict in the story with her brother. Her brother is a kind of a slumlord landlord, and he's black, and he rents to poor blacks, and he charges a high gouging price. And he talks. Macon is her brother, and Pilate, and then Milkman is Macon's son. And he's young or old enough now to begin to get into the business, and he wants to teach his son some things. This is Macon's perspective of Pilate. He's already kind of told her to stay away from her. Well, what's wrong with her? Well, did she cut somebody's throat? Well, she doesn't look like that, Daddy. Well, she is like that. What did she do to you? It ain't what she did, it's what she is. What is she? Here's Macon. A snake. I told you. Ever hear the story about the snake? The man who saw a little baby snake on the ground? Well, the man saw this baby snake bleeding and hurt, lying there in the dirt. And the man felt sorry for it and picked it up and put it in his basket and took it home. And he fed it and took care of it till it was big and strong. Fed it the same thing he ate. Then one day, the snake turned on him and bit him, stuck his poison tongue right in the man's heart, And while he was laying there dying, he turned to the snake and asked him, "What'd you do that for?" he said. "Didn't I take good care of you? Didn't I save your life?" The snake said, "Yes." "Then what'd you do it for? What'd you kill me for?" Know what the snake said? Said, "But you knew I was a snake, didn't you?" Now, I mean for you to stay out of that wine house, that's where Pilate is, and as far away from Pilate as you can. Milkman lowered his head. His father had explained nothing to him. The question was, what's wrong with Pilate? And he just says she's a snake and tells the story, but there's no connection yet for Milkman. Here's the perspective of Pilate that Macon brings as he explains her to his son. "Boy, you..." Her lips didn't start moving again until he was out of sight and running down the road. Pilate. Think about, we're going to keep going here. Think about Job. Job, in that whole story, we step back and don't try to analyze step by step. The whole story. Job cannot come to God. And God does not come to Job until he stripped himself of everything. That's kind of an existential identity of, what am I apart from my, for Job, it's his oxes and his asses and his seven kids and his beautiful wife and all his wealth. What am I apart from that? I don't know. Well, then we'll take it away and we'll see who you are. It's not unlike a lot of New Testament commandments from Jesus. Love me more than your brother or sister. Love me more than your mother or father. Get rid of your job and follow me. I will get rid of all this stuff. It's kind of an existential stripping down. Then you can come to God. Well, Toni Morrison understands that concept, I think biblically as well. And here's what she says about Pilate. It, the pronoun, refers to having no navel. It isolated her. Already without family, she was further isolated from her people, for except for the relative bliss on one island a long time ago, every other resource was denied her. Partnership in marriage, confessional friendship, communal religion. Men frowned, women whispered, and shoved their children behind them. Even a traveling sideshow would have rejected her, since her freak quality lacked that important ingredient, the grotesque. There was really nothing to see. Her defect, frightening and exotic as it was also a theatrical failure. It needed intimacy, gossip, and the time it took for curiosity to become drowned. Finally, and here's the Job story and the existential kind of stripping, who am I? Finally, Pilate began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was, and would probably always be, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. What does it take to know who you are? First off, she cut her hair. A challenge to all of us. I mean, that's part of our identity, right? I mean, I watch my 15-year-old son every morning. It's part of his identity. He cares. Cut, Mommy, cut it wrong. Look at this one right here. Well, on and on it goes. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. Now Macon, her brother, who said, stay away from her, I'll tell you the one thing you need to know. Own things. He hasn't asked any questions about himself. He just bought into the American material way. This is how you make it. You own things, you have power. Remember what the next line was? You own things, and you own things that will own people. She tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy? And when am I sad? And what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What is true in the world? Her mind traveled crooked streets and aimless goat paths, arriving sometimes at profundity, other times at the revelations of a three-year-old. The consequence of the knowledge she had made up or acquired kept her just barely within the boundaries of the elaborately socialized world of black people. Her respect for other people's privacy which they were all very intense about, was balancing. She gave up, apparently, all interest in table manners or hygiene, but acquired a deep concern for and about human relationships. And the book ends with Pilate dying, and she gets shot. The good die. Those who strip and deny all that the system offers die. That's the New Testament story too, right? Take on the system and you die. Jesus took on the system, and we can't, it's too radical. We can't have you part of that. Well, Pilate, and I only have one very short line to read, and you'll get the sense of all of it. She's with Milkman. Milkman didn't stay away from her, and she taught him all the lessons of life that he needed to learn, and he went way beyond owning things. But she's dying in Milkman's arm, and she says, I have to tell you, just a personal thing about this line before I read it. Whenever I go to communion, I'm a Lutheran, when I go to the Lutheran Church communion and just sit there and watch people go up and come back, we all do it, right? We all sit there and she got a new dress. Yeah, she looks good today. That guy's pants don't match his clothes. I mean, you know, we do that. And there hasn't been a communion that's gone by that I haven't thought of Pilate's death since I read this book. Here's why. She sighed. She's dying in the milkman's arms. Watch Reba for me. And then, I wish I'd have known more people. I would have loved them all. If I'd have known more, I would have loved more. What do you make of that? This stripping away of cut her hair, table manners, hygiene. And then she dies saying that. List all the things that she didn't have and what was left. Love. It fits Job. It fits Jesus' command. Leave your nets. Follow me. Then you'll know. But as long as we, Eric Fromm says in his book, You Shall Be as Gods, as long as we make our jobs, our parents, our families, all those kinds of things that are, in many cases, if held in the right perspective, are great, can we come to God? Job couldn't in his story. He thinks he's coming to God. He's got all these rituals he goes through, but he doesn't really have that communion with God until all is lost. Well, that's the theme that runs through this with Toni Morrison's, I think, Song of Solomon. Go ahead. Anything you responded to? Anything good? Any story that, any image that, ooh, I remember this or that? Or is this my Augustana class or what's it doing?
The thing that came to my mind was that stripping yourself of everything, but when you can do that, then you can really be what I think you call it love as being a person.
Yeah. Yeah. She asked, what's important to me? What makes me happy? When am I sad? Most of us don't, I mean, in this novel, they don't ask that. They just go about life and get going and, gee, I'm accumulating all this money, but her brother, Macon, accumulates all this money. He's got a wonderful wife. He's got three kids, and they are all so screwed up. And nobody likes him because he's such a jerk, you know, to put it succinctly and crudely. He has nothing, but he's got everything. Pilate has nothing, but she has everything. I wish I'd have known more. That's why I think about communion. I watch with you. Because you know everybody up there's got a story, even if their shirt and pants don't match. Mm-hmm. They have a story. Anybody else? Just responses.
I could listen to this without feeling uncomfortable because she was empowered, whereas the first reading you did with the person being just totally victimized, I could hardly listen to you. And I thought, well, now this book I could get. I don't know if I'm up to reading the first one.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't end that way. There is power in that book. But it's also, Go to the Mountain, the power kind of comes from its, from the reader, for understanding what oppression does, and then you switch it around. And don't oppress, and then you're empowered. But this one, yeah, that's a great statement. Pilate is empowered, but note how she's empowered. I think, as a student of literature, American and English literature in general, I look at black literature, and it seems to have, although all artists do it to some extent, this sense of you got to step out of all this secular stuff, and by secular I mean in the broadest sense of the word, the things that are social and are buying and are material and are and that can pull us away from identity, those self-understanding. It can pull us away from real love. It can pull us away from the question, when am I happy? When am I sad? The stuff that Elle, that she asks. We got 4 minutes. Color Purple. How many people have read this? It's a pretty popular book. Good. I'll just point out some generalizations about this. It's a series of letters, and the letters make up the novel. It's a real unconventional way because it's got some unconventional themes, too. And the letter starts out, Dear God. And they go, Dear God, Dear God, Dear God. We have all these series of letters, and here's the very first one. Dear God, I am 14. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me. What a beginning. What's happening to me? And there are a lot of things that are happening to her, but she means that not just physically. I'm growing up and I'm maturing, you know, physically. Yeah, and I'm pregnant, in fact. But what else? And Dear God. And all the letters go, Dear God, until finally she understands that this God has been delivered to her on a platter by the white system that says, who is God? It's this white Sunday school card God that has all these sets of values. Well, that God is exposed to her by a friend, and that's the only episode we'll look at. The friend says to her, you quit writing to God? The friend, his name is Shug, and the protagonist, the hero of the story, is Seeley. And Seeley says, I don't write to God anymore. And Shug says, well, why not? Because God doesn't do anything. God doesn't deliver, hasn't done. Well, you've been looking at the wrong God. And listen to the social insight that Seeley provides to what God is. The thing I believe, says Shug, God is inside you and inside everybody else. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it inside find it. And she's called God an it. Okay? And sometimes it just manifests itself even if you're not looking or don't know what you're looking for. Trouble do it for most folks, I think. Sorrow, Lord. Feeling like shit. It? I asked. Yeah, it. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. God love everything you love. And a mess of stuff you don't. But more than anything else, God love admiration. You saying God vain? I asked. Nah, she's saying not vain, just wanting to share a good thing. Here's where the title comes from. It's a wonderful line. It fits us at Holden. Fit me in my last hike up the Holden Lake. I walked so fast I didn't stop to take the flowers. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. Well, there's this celebration about God, and now it gets more. It's a Christian God too. It's always making little gods. God is always making little surprises and springing them on us when we least expect it. You mean God wants to be loved, just like the Bible say? Yes, Seeley, she say. Everything want to be loved. We sing and dance, make faces and give flower bouquets trying to be loved. You ever notice that trees do everything to get attention we do except walk? Well, us talk and talk about God, but I'm still adrift, trying to chase that old white man's picture out of my head. I've been so busy thinking about him, I never truly noticed nothing God made. Not a blade of corn. How it do that? Not the color purple. Where it come from? Not the little wildflowers, nothing. Now that my eye's opening, I feels like a fool. Next to any little scrub of a bush in my yard, Mister, this is a guy she's married to who abused her, Mister's evil just sort of shrinks. What do we got there? Whoa! Goodness has transcended for her, and you see it in the novel, anything evil that could happen to her. I'll read it again. next to any little scrub of a bush in my yard, Mr.'s evil sort of shrink. But not altogether. Still, it is like Shook say. You have to get a man off your eyeball before you can see anything at all. And here's the insight about what we've made our God. Man corrupt everything. I read a critic who criticized Alice Walker for being so feminist and just jumping all over men. Well, that critic is stupid and can't read. Sorry for being so direct. When she says man corrupt everything, she's not talking about males. She's talking about, you'll get it, won't you? Weave. Man corrupt everything, says Shug. He on your box of grits, right? My 15-year-old son looks at that box of Wheaties and sees that athlete and says, I gotta be an athlete. And he isn't gonna be an athlete, but he's still okay, right? We know that. But man's on your box of grits. And all these, all the whole value system, I'll go on with it. He on your box of grits, in your head, all over the radio. I think I've talked, maybe I'm gonna be in this class. Maya Angelou, black, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, opens her autobiography. I know I'm going to wake up and find out that I've got long blonde hair and blue eyes, and this space between my teeth that would hold the number two pencil will be gone. All of her ideas about beauty come from man corrupt everything. He's on your box of grits. He's on your radio. Well, he tried to make you think he everywhere. As soon as you think he everywhere, I'll underline this in your books, you don't have one, get it. As soon as you think he everywhere, you think he God. Amen. Look at Pilate. Make it. But he ain't. Whenever you're trying to pray and man plop himself on the other end of it, tell him to get lost. Conjure up flowers, wind, water. A big rock, love. And Celia's response is, but this is hard work, let me tell you. Man been there so long, he don't want to budge. But the telling by the author is the celebration that we have. Oh, I don't have to. Okay, your turn. Any responses?
Time to eat, 10 o'clock, or 10 to almost. Is the bell rung? It hasn't.
No, it's at 5, isn't it?
Huh? Five. Is it 5? Okay. Share away. You want to go buy The Color Purple now, or any of these books that are over there?
I think of that scene where, from The Color Purple, about finding God, where Celie sees, I think it's her friend, and her friend is in the store, and she's been beaten up. And the woman who she works for, owns her, whatever, sent her to buy groceries. And she sees Sophie Lee, and she says, when I see you in the store, I know there was a God. And I've forgotten that line.
Yeah.
It's so powerful.
Yeah. If you, very good. Thanks for sharing that. If you've seen the movie but haven't read the book, do read the book. That's a powerful scene, isn't it? And a powerful line. Very good. What kind of themes, what kind of, you know, we made those generalizations, that's why we started that, about Jesus' parable. What kind of generalizations do you make about what you've heard today? Just anything. Identity apart from what the system says you must be and what you must do and who you are. Stuff like that.
Caught up in the trappings of
all
the garbage we get.
Yep. Very good. Richard Wright says in his nonfiction, if it weren't for the blacks of America, no one would ever question democracy. We think we've got it, but they ask the questions, and wait a minute, we're doing this. Like, oh, we are. And so they step from the you know, we've got everything fine, right? No, look at yourself apart from the trappings of society. Do we really have freedom?
There's, in the writings, I think, an expression or a dignity that's expressed in a soulful way.
Yep. Very good.
Yeah, but it's always done in a soulful way.
Yeah.
There's like something beaten down there that a lot of times you don't get someplace else.
Good. And that creates the dignity. Is the dignity comes from what then? From something spiritual, rather than the Macon who says own things. I got my dignity. I'm a proud man when I walk down the street because I own this house and this house and this house and I drive this car. And Pilate says, "You don't have anything." She's got her dignity. That's a very good observation. Yeah.
How the man has controlled so much of the image that I think many people have of Black Americans, whether it be the image of street gangs, something very removed from what we're comfortable with.
Right. Very good. Who's controlled? Yes.
Yeah, we never really get some of the gifts that we really have because of the trappings. Because sometimes we don't even know what we're good at because we've been so busy trying to live up to the expectations of society of what's important to do and not important. We never find out what we can do real well and how much that can really help make the world a wonderful place. Because I'm always still searching for, you know, what I'm really good at and how that benefits other people. And so we don't have time to really search ourselves and really know ourselves.
Oh, what a great statement. That's right. We're too busy doing the, And the literature says, step back, take a look. I mean, Pilate does it. Shug does it for Sidi. Step back, look at your God. And it's, good.
Well, and not just...
Anybody can leave, of course. And then we can shoot around the breeze as long as you want. Go ahead.
And not just Black American novels. I think one of the reasons why Sire Solomon and the Colored People were so popular is because so many women in particular identified with them. I did. They were so incredibly empowering to me to read this book.
Yep.
It's just like a light turned on.
A great statement, too, and here we are, most of us in this room, white. It speaks to us all, and we need to know that. Yeah. Thanks for saying that. And I would say, as a white male, it spoke to me, too, and empowered me in a way to see things with a different vision, too. Great. I think they're serving millet and bread, so no.
Taco salad.
What book was that poem that you did last night on the lynching? Where did you find that?
Richard Wright is the poet, and the name of it is Between the World and Me, and it can be found, you remember?
Black Poets, but it's not in the...
They're out now, huh?
They're going to order, and they'll send it to you if you want them to.
The title of modern Black anthology will have it. Maybe one of the best small and inexpensive anthologies of Black American poetry is The Black Poets, edited by Dudley Randall, and that has that poem in it.
Yeah.
Andre Brink, sorry, my writing isn't very good.
By the way, Alan Payton is very Christian.
Yes,
very.
Yep. And
a lot of his poetry is very.
And he's. Do you know if he's alive or dead?
He died.
Just what I thought. Just not long ago, right? Yeah. Andre Brink is alive and well. And The Dry White Season is in the bookstore, and it's a movie now with two great movie stars. But who are they? Donald Sutherland and Marlon Brando.
What's the name of that film?
A Dry White Season. They didn't make. I think so. Won't get into the politics of it. It didn't really make the big screen much, but you can get it at any video store. But the book is a great book. I mean, it's a classic book, and the movie is not. Read the book.
One thing that occurred to me as I think about all this and your questions is that to the extent that we disallow any human being the right and the opportunity to be them, that gives us a measure of what we are doing to ourselves.
Yeah. It's a great statement. We disallow. Yeah. And as parents, boy, don't we do that too?
Yeah, Kelly?
I was just interested, so many parallels in the literature and what you shared and what you picked up with what's happening with youth and gangs, and so much of what youth are expressing is a reaction to the dominant culture and the many ways that their heritage has not been acknowledged and affirmed. And it almost looks like suicide, but it's a statement to the dominant culture.
Yeah.
And the hopelessness that's been self-created.
I don't think I'm telling any secret that he wouldn't want told. Verlaine, if you just got here, you don't know him, but he's black and he's the village pastor, told me that he was going through the system in his senior year. He just quit going to classes. And he just quit going. He's a very bright guy. And I went home and I read. And he told me what he read, and it was The Fire Next Time. It was Invisible Man. It was stuff by black authors. And he said, all of a sudden, what I was learning made some sense. He was enabled to go back to school by kind of countering that counterculture that had just made him invisible in all that was a part of his heritage and sense of who he was. Yeah, what a point. You got a session tonight at 6:45 too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You'll see connections, I'm sure.
In a sense in that, Go Tell It on the Mountain, when Richard was saying, look at me, I was thinking of how often I hear people say, well, I don't even see that they're black. And how can we say that? I mean, isn't, in a way, aren't we saying that we aren't looking at the person?
Yeah, I can't speak to that.
Aren't they also saying, though, they're looking beyond the skin? They're looking inside the person.
Maybe. The intimate friend could say that.
Yeah.
You know, and then the person who just off the street says, well, I don't even... The principal who hires and in come the two people interviewing, I don't even see that you're black. Mm-hmm. Wake up. Mm-hmm. You know. And there's... Yeah, that's a good point.
I had a unique experience. We live in Hong Kong. And as I was commuting for the first time, I run a lot. I was running in a park. And it suddenly felt very uncomfortable that I was different than everybody else there. Everybody in the park looked different than I did. And it was the first time in my life I was very conscious of that.
Yeah.
And very uncomfortable with it, by the way. And had a difficult time dealing with it for a period of time until I'd been there long enough where I didn't think of myself as different any longer. I mean, I was not conscious of the fact that I was different than other people.
I have felt that too, and I argue that everybody should feel that in their life, being the minority.
It's a, it's a real awakening for how insensitive and ignorant, unconsciously, that you are on your own. I don't remember how long we had been in Hong Kong. I was still in culture shock. I'm sure it was within the first 6 months or 7 months. And we were out with some other couples, and there aren't a lot of Guaylos there, white people. Mm-hmm. But there aren't a lot of, or brown eyes is what we are, there aren't a lot of blacks at all. There aren't very many. And my husband and some other couples were going into a restaurant, and I just sat for a while, and they came back out and came to get me. There was a performance going on in the central area, and there were four black couples, and I hadn't seen that many black people assembled together, and I was embarrassed that I hadn't noticed that I'd been missing it. And he just, what are you doing? He said, well, this is home. this is like connecting again. And it was a real awakening for me that was my culture too, that being mixed up more than just mm-hmm. All
along. Hmm. That's a good story. I'll share with you. Go ahead. In my African American literature classes at Augustana, a course that is about, courses that are about race consciousness and all the complexities that go into that. I ask students every year, every class, to list 5 or 10 adjectives or nouns that describe themselves. And I introduce it by saying, for instance, I would say I am a father, I am a runner, I am a teacher, I am a skier, and just like that. And then at the end I say, what did you put down? White kids never put white and black kids always put black. And then you ask the question, what is it about our culture that creates that awareness that's just a constant part of identity and the word and that creates gangs, that oppression is still there and not in a always or often even in a violent form. And you experience that by being that minority and the self-consciousness. If you were asked in China to list who you are, you'd probably put white, because you're conscious of your whiteness.
Right.
We have nothing to make us conscious of that if we're white.
Yeah.